Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver and Al Warren.
Glorious 6.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Joining me today, we've got Super Spy, Mr. Gavin Stone. How are you today?
I am great today, and I never know whether to say good evening or good morning because I don't know when this is going to air, so I'm just going to say hello.
It really doesn't matter. Every station airs it at different times, so you can say either, and you're right. I mean, it's Salt Lake, it's in the afternoon. It's Seattle, it's kind of 3:30 in the afternoon. L.A., it's 9, so...
Good morning, afternoon, or evening to wherever this is airing, then.
Yeah, it's a global world now. I don't know if you've heard of this thing. It's called the Internet, and it really changed things. Listen to us all over at all times. It's really convenient. Maybe we'll get you online one day soon.
Yeah, I've got to come out of the cave and stop being so much of a technophobe and keep up with these things, really.
Yeah, you're bad. Well, now we've got a guy on, and he's written a book, and he's had quite a life. He's been in your business, and, you know, the espionage and, you know, information business, spy business, it's all that stuff. And so he's written a book. The book is called A Spy Alone. And it says, so he's under the name of Charles Beaumont. And now, so welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about, so people know who you are. You were in, what exactly were you in before you written the book? And what led you to write this book?
Well, a long time ago, I worked in British intelligence, in the organization that some people call MI6. I would say that this book doesn't necessarily come from that at all. In fact, it comes more from my reflections on the world of Britain in the 21st century, the world of the sort of cynical international politics, finance, where all those things cross over, and Britain's relationships with Russia in the last 20 years or so. And that's really what I write about in this novel.
Well, you know, so in that kind of life, obviously you have to keep a lot of it secret, including your name and kind of, you know, a lot of what you had done. What is it that you wanted to get across in a book? Like, so when you're sitting there thinking about this, did you have some sort of a meaning? Was there a text? Was there some sort of thought in your mind that you wanted people to get out of a book that you wrote, or was it just going to be purely entertainment?
I think one of the things I wanted to explore was whether or not there could be a sort of Russian mole at the heart of the British establishment in the 2020s. So my book is set right in the modern era. And what I'm trying to do, because we're very familiar with these Cold War stories. We're very familiar with whether it's, you know, in the US, maybe Aldrich Ames, or whether in the UK, people like Kim Philby and so on. But that feels like quite old history now. I'm trying to think about, would something like that exist in these days, in an era where the idea of people, you know, being converted to the communist cause or something like that is clearly no longer relevant. And so that was the sort of underlying idea that I was trying to explore in the book.
And so I guess, do you have to, you know, this is kind of a generic question, but do you have to get it checked with MI6 or any sort of agencies before you publish a book?
The rules in the UK are, as with many things in the UK, slightly unclear to many people. We like to make things up as we go along. But I'm led to understand that the government does not object to this book having been released.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I went off the theory of it's better to seek forgiveness than permission.
A very good guide by which to live your life.
Definitely. So in the main character Simon, how much of Simon, or how much of yourself is in Simon, shall we say?
Well, you know, all novelists get asked is this autobiography, or is this all fiction? And I think quite a lot of it is more a sort of confection of people that I've observed and sort of life experiences that I've seen from people I've worked with or worked alongside, or, you know, people I have knowledge of. But I guess, you know, the character of Simon in the book, the protagonist, he's somebody who is a little bit world weary, a little bit, I don't want to say depressed, but somebody who feels that maybe Britain has slightly lost its way in the modern era. And I think I share a couple of those thoughts, that we're a country that doesn't quite seem to know where it's going. And certainly some of our international relations have not necessarily been a great success in recent years. So I think there's a bit of me in there, I'm sure.
Oh, no doubt. I know that there was one line in the book which straight away I read it said just a middle-aged spy getting scared of the dark or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, what a relatable character. And then I thought to myself, or is it just me?
Well, right, yeah, I mean, obviously, the one thing this protagonist is not is a kind of James Bond style superhero. It's very much based in a real person who I hope that an average reader could identify with and not feel that they're sort of reading things that they themselves couldn't possibly imagine.
I would imagine that would be the hardest thing, right? Trying to decide how wild you can go in a story like this, because there's so much out there now with everything from Reacher to, you know, James Bond has come a long way.
That's right. And I think in a way that was what propelled me to go for the other end of the scale. So to try to be very authentic and very believable. And what I mean by that particularly is to nest it in a world that people will recognize. So even if you're not involved in the intelligence world, I've sort of drawn on events that happened in real life in recent years, or notably the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also things such as these open source so-called OSINT analysts who've been able from outside the intelligence.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
As well, to discover all kinds of things about what Russian special services have been up to. So kind of using that framework of bringing real events into a fictional setting, which I think helps people to sort of perhaps believe that maybe there's some truth to the novel, although I hasten to add it is just fiction.
Oh, sure. When you're putting the characters in and when you're creating characters to do a story like this, where do they come from then? Are they coming from people you've come across over your years of that kind of lifestyle, or are they completely out of the blue?
I think almost every character I've written is a sort of confection of a few real people and then sort of taking them off in a slightly different direction. You know, partly, of course, because I don't want to depict real people. Maybe, you know, there are real people who have lawyers, and also, you know, that there are elements of the story that are just more interesting if you create your own character. But I can't speak for other novelists, but I think I always began with someone in my mind that I knew, and then I sort of, it's almost like sort of making something out of clay, you know, you mold on other elements from other characters and other ideas, and eventually, hopefully, you have someone who's quite original.
Now, I imagine you're an extremely well-read individual, which is always a bonus for anybody starting out in writing, but how did you fare going from the extreme of writing, you know, reports to the completely kind of new world of writing fiction? What were the challenges that you had along the way doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Gavin. I think one thing is that I think there's a sense that fiction has lots of description. And obviously, you know, clearly if you need to depict a world and a scene and a setting. But what I found was that actually the world of writing sort of government type reports, intel type reports, is quite helpful, because there's always an emphasis there on not overusing words, on not, you know, filling the page with endless adjectives and superlatives and all the rest of it. And actually, I thought that was quite helpful to a novelist because, of course, you always end up having to cut stuff out and your editors are always sort of encouraging you to slim it down a little. So I think in some ways that background, that professional background of writing very factual, quite sort of sober reports is probably quite helpful.
Yeah, got you. Did you do any like kind of classes or courses, or did you just go straight in for the kill to try and put a draft together and then kind of, once you got your manuscript, get the editor to work with you from there, or what was the process for you?
Yeah, well, I've no courses or anything. I'm completely untrained. So I thought I'd just give it a go, basically. It seems to have worked out okay. I guess I'm a voracious reader. I've read a lot of spy literature. I've read a lot of other literature. I'm a huge fan of certainly John le Carré, Len Dayton, some of those sort of classic writers, and also more recently, you know, there's great, well, you've got I.S. Berry writing, you've got David McCloskey, two great contemporary novelists, Americans, obviously, Charles Cumming in the UK, Mick Herron. There are so many great writers in this genre at the moment that it's quite easy to get inspiration, I think, from just sort of reading what's out there. At the moment I'm enjoying reading Joseph Cannon, who's obviously another great American espionage writer.
And was there anything that you kind of, when you first set out, like, kind of, right, that's it, I'm going to write a spy book, was there an inspiration within the literature world that you looked at and thought, I want it to be so much more like this, or this particular person's writing style, or was it just an accumulation of all the great authors you've just mentioned?
I don't think I was particularly trying to sort of emulate the style of anyone, but I was inspired, actually. Inspired might seem an odd choice of word, but I was inspired by the sad passing of John le Carré and the fact that he was no longer writing. And I admired him so much as a writer that I thought, because it had always been on my mind, I'd have a go at trying to write a novel. So I kind of thought, well, you know, you can't, like anyone, everyone thinks they've got a book in them, but if you don't sit down and write the thing, then you don't know if you have or not. So there was something about that, the sort of the reminder of mortality made me sort of get my act together and actually start writing.
Yeah, I can imagine that being quite sobering, to be fair. And I've got a confession, I haven't quite got to the end of the book yet, but I'm not going to give any spoilers. But that being said, will there be, do you have intentions of this becoming an ongoing series, or do you think, what are the next steps in kind of your world from here?
Yeah, well, there's no secret that I'm definitely writing a second, because I've been working on it all day and it's very much on my mind at the moment. So yeah, I'm writing a second and I hope to write a trilogy. So that's my sort of plan, and it will be a trilogy about this ring of spies, which as I mentioned to Alan earlier, you know, the trying to look at the idea of whether there could be a Russian mole in the British establishment in the 2020s, and what would that be like, and then the second and third book sort of slightly expand to there being a sort of network of spies, and how that unfolds is what the trilogy deals with.
How do you decide what kind of politics you're going to get involved with? Because it's such a, you know, I don't know what you call it. It's really kind of a loud world right now, and it's very extreme on one side or the other, it seems like. And with current events, how do you decide how you're going to frame events or things that happen in your book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think people reading my book will probably draw their own conclusions about where my own politics lie. It's not a political book. I don't think anyone would, unless they had very, you know, sort of particular political stance, I don't think anyone would need to be put off by it. But I think at the end of the day, I had a worldview about some mistakes that Britain had made, making our, particularly around the issue of kind of Russian interference, financial interference. A lot of Russian money came into the British economy, came into the City of London. that feeling about that, you know, that could be a political view to take, but I think people across the political spectrum probably now reflect that that wasn't a brilliant idea for Britain to have done that. And I don't hide from the fact in the book that I feel strongly about the situation in Ukraine. And in fact, I've dedicated the book to the people of Ukraine as they continue their fight for freedom. So again, if someone has politically feels that Ukraine deserves what's happening to them, then they probably won't like my book. But I think those are quite small categories of people.
Yeah, but they're loud people.
That's true. They are. That's,
you know, and you know, and I always think of things as it's not so much political, because I you know, I hear something and I think, well, I think of the idea and think about whether it's right or wrong, not about whether it's left or right. You just have to be careful, because there's people out there creating stories, you know, as well. So it's a strange world. So what about current events, like things like that are happening today? Do you bring that into your writing, or are you staying away from things that are happening?
No, I'm very much the opposite. I'm sort of all in with current events, and that's been, I've only written one novel, I can't really say it's my style, but it was certainly the style of that book. And it's the style of the one I'm writing now. I wanted the reader to feel that they were almost reading something that was sort of what sits behind the news that they see on TV or whatever online. So the book is unfolding as the war in Ukraine is unfolding. I don't name real people, but there's a sense that the person who is the Prime Minister of Britain might well be the person who was actually the Prime Minister at that time. And in the second book that I'm writing now, it's very much, again, the events and the incidents are totally fictitious, but the backdrop is the unfolding war in Ukraine. And I've been quite careful, and I've been going back over all kinds of reports to make sure that I'm corresponding it to the thread, the narrative of what really has been happening in that war.
It's interesting. I guess, do you have to worry about things changing? Like, I get, because like when you write something that's current event, it could change, or it might not happen the way you write it, and so that it kind of, will it outdate what you put in your book?
Yeah, I think that is a challenge. So when I started writing, the war in Ukraine hadn't begun. So that required me to change the book. And essentially, the book is set not quite in the present. It's set sort of 18 months ago, and in that sense, at least I've just got a tiny bit of sort of protection against the changes you describe there. But of course, what we don't know is the subsequent outcome. We don't yet know how this war will end, for example. So I just have to be cautious about that. But I'm hopeful that the specific plot of the story doesn't require a certain outcome or require me to sort of speculate too far forward.
What do you get out of doing the book? What does it do for you?
That's a really good question. I think for the first book, it was very much that, can I do this? You know, do because I think a lot of people have wondered if they might write a novel, and of course, lots of people write novels and for various reasons they might not get finished or might not get published eventually. So I guess for the first book it was that sort of sense of, can I do this? But wanting to say something, as I mentioned, this sort of underlying idea of the way in which elements of British society and I think maybe Western society in general allowed themselves to become too open to kind of, you know, kleptocrats' money, bluntly. I felt that was something that was worth saying. So what I got out of it was I enjoyed the creativity. I love creating characters, and it goes back to the question earlier that you amalgamate people and types, but actually fundamentally creating characters, creating dialogue. I've enjoyed that a lot. And then writing this second book, I think there's slightly an urge to sort of see, well, can I do this a second time? You know, was it a fluke? People have been quite positive about the first book, which has been a wonderful experience. You know, it's great to have positive reader feedback. So now I'm trying to see if I could do it again, and that that sort of personal challenge. I imagine that might be what drives a lot of writers forwards.
Yeah. Do you have an estimated date for when the second book might be on the shelves?
I think it should be towards the end of this year. So, you know, things are moving pretty quickly on that. So hopefully it roughly a year from when the first book came out, people will be able to sort of pick up the sequel.
That's great. And will you be kind of planting things in book two that might be more relevant in book three? So some of these little Easter eggs that people put in to kind of give people a hint as to what might be coming in three of the trilogy?
Yeah, definitely. And also hopefully there'll be things that were relatively minor elements of the first book that slightly open up a bit more in book two. There is a slight challenge, of course, now that I've written book one, you know, I obviously can't change it. So you're slightly, there's one little plot point I got a bit stuck on because I'd wished I'd written something slightly different in the first book. But that's what a first time novelist does. You know, you make these little problems for yourself.
I've definitely been there and done that. And going slightly like away from the book, just to like kind of the current world that we've been talking about with regards to for Ossint and that kind of thing. You've got the likes of Bellingcat now and companies popping up all over the place, like private intelligence companies. There's more and more of what I used to do in the contractors, not just boots on the ground stuff, but the kind of sitting behind the desk and the analyst stuff. What are your feelings on that, on more and more kind of private contractors being used within the intelligence industry?
Well, I think it's a really fascinating world, and one that people outside that world, people who don't have the background, Gavin, that you have or I might have, that people still don't know very much. So I'm quite interested to keep writing novels that talk as much about that world as they do about the world of government spies, because I think a lot of spying is now done by people who aren't employed by governments, and they are, yes, they might be working for private businesses, or they might just be a kind of loose collective of people working online, working together. Bellingcat is a great example of that. For those not familiar, you know, Bellingcat is a kind of online collective of expert open source intelligence researchers who've made extraordinary discoveries and particularly in relation to some of the things that Russia did, such as the shooting down the Malaysian airliner, such as the identifying the two assassins who came to Salisbury, England, to attempting to assassinate Sergei Skripal, those sorts of things. It's remarkable, and I don't think the world of fiction and of the creative world has actually caught up with that reality.
Oh yeah, without doubt there, because I mean right now I think there's a huge percentage of the intelligence industry that's using kind of or outsourcing and using contractors, and yeah, I think you're definitely on the button there with that, because it is something that it's getting bigger and not getting kind of noted in the literary world.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see whether or not there's a bit of a trend now for that to sort of develop in literature and also on the screen, of course, because again that's clearly very important. You know, there's a lot of great spy on-screen spy stuff at the moment, and obviously there's Slow Horses, people love watching that in the UK, and I'm sure it's being watched elsewhere. But again, that's still quite traditional in the framing of a sort of government service.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen Slow Horses yet, but I've been told it's quite good, so that's something that's on my list.
definitely to look forward to, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I'll definitely be getting into that then. Is there anything that kind of when you were writing the book that either you did put in and then took out, you don't have to say what it is, but that you did put in and took out because you thought, maybe I shouldn't say that, or is there anything that you wish you could have put in, especially for the sake of, the story, that you kind of left out and thought, it's a shame that I can't mention that, and would have been really, really enhanced the story somehow?
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, one of the funny things is around the names of characters, and I know that lots of novelists can get quite stuck on this and can invest a lot of effort in. If I'm very honest, I think my character names are relatively sort of lightly worn, you know, they're just names I've alighted on. But in one particular case, in the working draft of the novel, I had a name for a certain Russian character, and I couldn't quite remember why I'd chosen that name. So I put it into Google, and I realized I'd actually was using the name of a real Russian intelligence officer. I better probably better change that, because that isn't necessarily going to go very well for me.
No, you end up going missing.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think the general public gets wrong about the spy world? And I know that, you know, it, in movies and TV and stuff, it's made to look very exotic, I guess. You know, the spies all look perfect and they have great clothes and they can do amazing things in these movies and stuff. But what is it that really goes on in the spy world that people don't understand?
Well, I think certainly you're right. Obviously, in the end, the movies in particular have to look good in a way that you know, normal humans that don't always manage to. But I think one thing that people would not necessarily expect is how much remains ambiguous and just remains unclear. So we, in stories, you always want a satisfactory ending. You know, you want there to be someone who was guilty or someone who can be exposed. You want the undercover agent to be able to discover the plot and hopefully foil the plot. In real life, a lot of times, intel agencies and also intel, you know, the people working in commercial intel are dealing with incomplete information and doing their best to understand things. And that's about as far as they get. You know, they don't get a full answer to a question. They make their best estimate. And I think that's something. And of course, that can be quite hard to put into literature. People don't want to read a book that feels like it, you know, the ending doesn't reach a conclusion. But that is definitely a feature of the real world that perhaps isn't reflected very often in the sort of entertainment side.
So when you're writing, how do you yourself experience your characters, and how do you develop the dialogue? For instance, like, do you hear your characters in your head? Do you see it like a movie? What's kind of the situation for you?
I think I mostly hear it. And I perhaps in my head, I'm sort of seeing a slightly kind of a sort of translucent movie. So it's not a fully formed picture. And I find I probably spend a certain amount of time muttering to myself little snatches of dialogue. So maybe if someone was in the room with me, they'd think I'd gone a bit crazy. And then I quite often I find if I go for a walk, it really helps. You know, there's obviously something about the physical activity of walking, and maybe it's just that's what it does to your circulation or something that really helps me if I've got a bit stuck. But I find I've always found dialogue not too difficult. For me, perhaps slightly harder is the sort of the bridging passages, the description of a journey or the description of a sort of setting in which someone finds themselves that I've sort of had to work a bit harder on.
So when you go something like this and you kind of go put your characters through these experiences and kind of live through the book for however long it takes you to write it, do you think it changes you?
Yeah, I think it does definitely. I think, for example, in the first novel, there were two things. One, that I'm avoiding spoilers here, but there's an important character who dies at a certain point in the book, and I realized that that's quite a big thing to do to the reader, because they've decided, you know, they may not like the character, or they hopefully they would, but that, you know, they've decided that they're emotionally invested in that person. So I realized that I had this sort of responsibility to readers that hadn't occurred to me, because I think particularly when you've never written anything that other people have read, or certainly not fiction, then you don't realize you're writing it for everyone else. You're not really writing it for yourself.
I wonder, who do you get inspiration from, and not necessarily other writers? I mean, of course, Gavin is a big inspiration for most people, but other than Gavin, who where do you get inspiration from?
That's a good question. I I'm quite inspired, I think, by those that have gone before. You know, there are some big characters in the world of sort of intelligence, particularly if we go back to the Second World War. You know, there were people who in their 20s were being parachuted into occupied Europe, perhaps because they'd studied languages at university. And, you know, these days we don't expect people in their 20s to move out of their parents' house. So, you know, it's incredible if you think about what those people did. And similarly, in the Cold War, I think there were like any period of history, there were highs and lows, but there were some extraordinary achievements. You know, the CIA and MI6 and other intelligence agencies managed some amazing things. If we think about the resolution of some great crises, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, the role intelligence played in that, or the ending of the Cold War and the role that we subsequently learned from accounts that have come out and subsequent books and so on, that the role, for instance, played by Oleg Gordievsky, who was this KGB agent who was working for the Western intelligence agencies. So those sorts of things, these are quite inspiring characters. And in that sense, whilst I think there is often a temptation to write about intelligence agencies as fairly cynical organizations, I certainly don't adhere to the idea that these are kind of rogue agencies. I think a lot of, particularly in movies now, it's almost always a government conspiracy at the end of the story. And I'm not really sure I go for that.
Mm. Did you always know growing up that this would be the road you'd take? Did you have a feeling as a kid? Do you think, yep, that's what I'm going to do when I'm older? Or was it something that you just ended up going down that route and it was kind of something like you had the offer and were like, I'd enjoy that. How did it go?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wasn't something I thought I'd be involved with, and it was just sort of, it was, you know, the way things worked out and the opportunity was there. And I was, you know, lucky to have that chance. I mean, these days people can apply, certainly in the British context, they can apply to intelligence agencies via a website. I don't know how the system is in the US. And you know, if it's a great way to involve yourself in public service.
Yeah, for sure. And is there anything that, like, because I know you have done a couple of other interviews, is there anything that you afterwards would be like, I wish they'd have asked me this, I really want to talk about this particular part of the book or my life or anything like that we haven't asked you that you'd like to tell everybody?
I mean, I'm just delighted to have the opportunity. The one thing I would say about the book is that I dropped in quite a few sort of Easter eggs for people who are really into the kind of intelligence history and the sort of the culture and the stories of the sort of intelligence world. So I hope that some of those are enjoyed by readers of the book. And there's one or two sort of pen portraits of people who are very peripheral characters, but who may correspond to real people in the real world. And that was, again, more there for a sort of little amusement for one or two readers. So I hope people get something from that.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Well, so listen, have you got a social media presence set up for the book and a website and all that? Do you interact with readers? Or because I know it's not your real name and it's not what, you know, it's not who you are, but do you have something set up or do you stay away from that?
No, so I'm on X, formerly known as Twitter, and I've had quite a few very nice interactions with readers on there. And then there's also, Gavin and I know each other from, there's a wonderful Facebook group for enthusiasts of spy literature called Spybury, Facebook group Spybury, which again, I'm always delighted when people, have something to say on there. Interacting with readers and potential readers has been one of the real pleasures of this whole experience.
Well, fantastic. And, of course, it's all under Charles Bowman, I'd imagine.
That's right. And I have realized now that I chose the name quite randomly, but that there is another Charles Beaumont who long since dead, but was an American author of kind of science fiction, I think. So I'm not that one. I'm the other one.
You're the other one. You're the one still alive.
Right, I'm still alive. But I mean, it wasn't his real name either, to be fair. So for some reason, we all just like this name.
Wow. You know, if there ever was a real Charles Beaumont, he's got to be thrilled. You know, people sending him all sorts of stuff, you know. Well, we really appreciate you being on the show, talking about your book. And, of course, we'll have the book up and everything else we can about you. And, of course, it's called A Spy Alone. And, of course, our guest, Charles Beaumont, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.